It had been a Sunday afternoon in August, a time when traffic along the street dropped steeply. Later on, by 5 or so, things would begin to pick up again, and from 6 to sunset the broad path along the lake would be thronged. But 3 in the afternoon was low tide. The Methodists were back in session over in Harlow for their afternoon song service. At Warrington's, the assembled company of vacationing Flatlanders was sitting down to a heavy mid-afternoon Sabbath meal of roast chicken or ham. All over the township, families were addressing their own Sunday dinners. Those who had already finished were snoozing through the heat of the day, in a hammock wherever possible. Sarah liked this quiet time, loved it, really. She had spent a great deal of her life on Kearney midways and in smoky gin joints, shouting out her songs in order to be heard above the voices of red-faced, unruly drunks. And while part of her loved the excitement and unpredictability of that life, part of her loved the serenity of this one, too, the peace of these walks. She wasn't getting any younger, after all. She had a kid who had by now left pert near all his babyhood behind him. On that particular Sunday, she must have thought the street almost too quiet. She walked a mile south from the meadow without seeing a soul. Even Keto was gone by then, having stopped off to pick berries. It was as if the whole township was deserted. She knows there's an Eastern Star supper in Kashwakamak, of course. Has even contributed a mushroom pie to it because she has made friends of some of the Eastern Star ladies. They'll all be down there getting ready. What she doesn't know is that today is also dedication day for the New Grace Baptist Church, the first real church ever to be built on the TR. A slug of locals have gone, heathen as well as Baptist. Faintly, from the other side of the lake, she can hear the Methodists singing "The Old Rugged Cross." The sound is sweet and faint and beautiful. Distance and echo has tuned every sour voice. She isn't aware of the men, most of them very young men, the kind who, under ordinary circumstances, dare only look at her from the corners of their eyes, until the older one among them speaks.
"Well now, a black whore in a white dress and a red belt. Damn if that ain't just a little too much color for Lakeside. What's wrong with you, whore? Can't you take a hint?"
She turns toward him, afraid but not showing it. She has lived 36 years on this earth, has known what a man has and where he wants to put it since she was 11, and she understands that when men are together like this and full of red eye, she can smell it. They give up thinking for themselves and turn into a pack of dogs. If you show fear, they will fall on you like dogs and likely tear you apart like dogs. Also, they have been laying for her. There can be no other explanation for them turning up like this.
"What hint is that, sugar?" she asks, standing her ground. Where is everyone? Where can they all be? God damn!
Across the lake, the Methodists have moved on to trust and obey, a droner if there ever was one.
"That you ain't got no business walking where the white folks walk," Harry Oster says.
His adolescent voice breaks into a kind of mouse squeak on the last word, and she laughs. She knows how unwise that is, but she can't help it. She's never been able to help her laughter, any more than she's ever been able to help the way men like this look at her breasts and bottom. Blame it on God.
"Why, I walk where I do," she says. "I was told this was common ground. Ain't nobody got a right to keep me out. Ain't nobody has. You seen them doing it?"
"You see us now," George Armbruster says, trying to sound tough.
Sarah looks at him with a species of kindly contempt that makes George shrivel up inside. His cheeks glow hot red.
"Son," she says, "you only come out now because the decent folks is all somewheres else. Why do you want to let this old fella tell you what to do? Act decent and let a lady walk."
"I see it all." As DeVore fades and fades, at last becoming nothing but eyes under a blue cap in the rainy afternoon, through him I can see the shattered remains of my swimming float washing against the embankment. I see it all. I see her as she starts forward, walking straight at DeVore.
If she stands here jawing with them, something bad is going to happen. She feels it, and she never questions her feelings. And if she walks at any of the others, old Massa bore in on her from the side, pulling the rest after. Old Massa in the little old blue cap is the wheel dog, the one she must face down. She can do it, too. He's strong, strong enough to make these boys one creature, his creature, at least for the time being. But he doesn't have her force, her determination, her energy. In a way, she welcomes this confrontation. Reg has warned her to be careful, not to move too fast or try to make real friends until the rednecks, only Reggie calls them the Bull Gators, show themselves. How many and how crazy. But she goes her own course, trusts her own deep instincts. And here they are, only seven of them, and really just the one Bull Gator. I'm stronger than you, old Massa, she thinks, walking toward him. She fixes her eyes on his and will not let them drop. His are the ones that drop. His the mouth that quivers uncertainly at one corner. His the tongue that comes out as quick as a lizard's tongue to wet the lips. And all that's good. But even better is when he falls back a step. When he does that, the rest of them cluster in two groups of three, and there it is, her way through. Faint and sweet are the Methodists. Faithy music carrying across the lake's still surface. A droner of a hymn, yes, but sweet across the miles. When we walk with the Lord in the light of His Word, what a glory He sheds on our way. I'm stronger than you, Sugar, she says. I'm meaner than you. You may be the Bull Gator, but I'm the Queen Bee, and if you don't want me stinging on you, you best clear me the rest of my path. You bitch, he says. But his voice is weak. He is already thinking, this isn't the day. There's something about her he didn't quite see until he saw her right up close. Some black nigger hoogan he didn't feel until now. Better wait for another day, better. Then he trips over a root or a rock. Perhaps it's the very rock behind which she will finally come to rest, and falls down. His cap falls off, showing the big old bald spot on top of his head. His pants split all the way up to the seam, and Sarah makes a crucial mistake. Perhaps she underestimates Jared DeVore's own very considerable personal force, or perhaps she just cannot help herself. The sound of his britches ripping is like a loud fart. In any case, she laughs, that raucous, smoke-broken laugh which is her trademark, and her laugh becomes her doom. DeVore doesn't think. He simply gives her the leather from where he lies, big feet and pegged logger's boots shooting out like pistons. He hits her where she is thinnest and most vulnerable, in the ankles. She hollers in shocked pain as the left one breaks. She goes down in a tumble, losing her furled parasol out of one hand. She draws in breath to scream again, and Jared says from where he is lying, "Don't let her! Dasn't let her holler!" Ben Merrill falls on top of her full length, all 190 pounds of him. The breath she is drawn to scream with whooshes out in a gusty, almost silent sigh instead. Ben, who has never even danced with a woman, let alone lay on top of one like this, is instantly excited by the feel of her struggling beneath him. He wriggles against her, laughing, and when she rakes her nails down his cheek, he barely feels it. The way it seems to him, he's all cock and a yard long. When she tries to roll over and get out from under that way, he rolls with her, lets her be on top, and he is totally surprised when she drives her forehead down on his. He sees stars, but he is 18 years old, as strong as he will ever be, and he loses neither consciousness nor his erection. Oren tears away the back of her dress, laughing. "Pig pile," he cries in a breathy little whisper, and drops on top of her. Now he is dry-humping her topside, and Ben Merrill is dry-humping just as enthusiastically from underneath, dry-humping like a billy goat, even with the blood pouring down the sides of his head from the split in the center of his brow. And she knows that if she can't scream, she is lost. If she can scream, and if Keto hears, he'll run and get help, run and get Reg. But before she can try again, old Massa is squatting beside her and showing her a long bladed knife.
"Make a sound and I'll cut your nose off," he says.
And that's when she gives up. They have brought her down after all, partly because she laughed at the wrong time, mostly out of pure, buggerly bad luck. Now they will not be stopped, and best that Keto should stay away. Please God, keep him back where he was. It was a good patch of berries, one that should keep him occupied an hour or more. He loves berry picking, and it won't take these men an hour. Harry Oster yanks her hair back, tears her dress off one shoulder, and begins to suck her on her neck. Old Massa, the only one not at her. Old Massa standing back, looking both ways along the street, his eyes slitted and wary. Old Massa looked like a mangy timber wolf done eating a whole generation of chicken house chickens while managing to avoid every trap and snare.
"Hey, Irish, quit on her a minute," he tells Harry, and widens his wise gaze to the others. "Get her in the puckies, you damn fools. Get her in there deep."
They don't. They can't. They are too eager to have her. They arm yank her behind the forehead of gray rock and call it good. She doesn't pray easily, but she prays now. She prays for them to let her live. She prays for Keto to stay clear, to keep filling his bucket slow by eating every third handful. She prays that if he does take a notion to catch up with her, he will see what's happening and run the other way as fast as he can. Run silent and get Reg.
"Stick this in your mouth," George pants, "and don't you bite me, you bitch."
They take her top and bottom, back and front, two and three at a time. They take her where anybody coming along can't help but see them, and old Massa stands off a little, looking first at the panting young men grouped around her, kneeling with their trousers down and their thighs scratched from the bushes they are kneeling in. Then he peers up and down the path with his wild and wary eyes. Incredibly, one of them, it is Fred Dean, says, "Sorry, ma'am," after he shot his load, feels like halfway up to East Bejesus. It's as if he accidentally kicked her in the shin while crossing his legs. And it doesn't end. There's cum down her throat, cum running down the crack of her ass. The young one has bitten the blood right out of her left breast, and it doesn't end. They are young, and by the time the last one is finished, the first one, oh God, the first one is ready again. Across the river, the Methodists are now singing Blessed Assurance, Jesus is Mine. And as old Massa approaches her, she thinks, "It's almost over, woman. Heave and last. Hold on steady and it'll be over." He looks at the skinny redhead and the one who keeps squinching his eye up and tossing his head and tells them to watch the path. He's going to take his turn now that she's broke in. He unbuckles his belt. He unbuttons his flies. He pushes down his underwear, dirty black at the knees and dirty yellow at the crotch. And as he drops a knee on either side of her, she sees that old Massa's little Massa is just as floppy as a snake with its neck broke. And before she can stop it, that raucous laugh bursts all unexpected from her again. Even lying here, covered with the hot jelly spend of her rapists, she can't help but see the funny side.
"Shut up,"
DeVore growls at her, and smashes the heel of one hard hand across her face, breaking her cheekbone and her nose.
"Shut up that howling."
"Reckon it might get stiffer if it was one of your boys laying here with his rosy red ass stuck up in the air, sugar?"
she asks. And then, for the last time, Sarah laughs. DeVore draws his hand back to hit her again, his naked loins lying against her naked loins, his penis a flaccid worm between them. But before he can bring the hand down, a child's voice cries,
"Ma! What they doing to you, Ma? Get off my mama, you bastards!"
She sits up in spite of DeVore's weight, her laughter dying, her wide eyes searching Keto out and finding him, a slim young boy of eight standing on the street, dressed in overalls and a straw hat and brand new canvas shoes, carrying a tin bucket in one hand. His lips are blue with juice. His eyes are wide with confusion and fright.
"Run, Keto!" she screams. "Run away, huh?"
Red fire explodes in her head. She swoons back into the bushes, hearing old Massa from a great distance.
"Get him. Don't you let him ramble now."
Then she's going down a long, dark slope. She's lost in a ghost house corridor that leads only deeper and deeper into its own convoluted bowels. From that deep falling place, she hears him. She hears her darling one. He is screaming. I heard him screaming as I knelt by the gray rock with my carry bag beside me and no idea how I'd gotten to where I was. I certainly had no memory of walking here. I was crying in shock and horror and pity. Was she crazy? Well, no wonder. No fucking wonder. The rain was steady but no longer apocalyptic. I stared at my fishy white hands on the gray rock for a few seconds, then looked around. DeVore and the others were gone. The ripe and gassy stench of decay filled my nose. It was like a physical assault. I fumbled in the carry bag, found the steno mask Rami and George had given me as a joke, and slipped it over my mouth and nose with fingers that felt numb and distant. I breathed shallowly and tentatively. Better. Not a lot, but enough to keep from fleeing, which was undoubtedly what she wanted. No! She cried from somewhere behind me as I grabbed the spade and dug in. I tore a great mouth in the ground with the first swipe, and each subsequent one deepened and widened it. The earth was soft and yielding, woven through with mats of thin roots which parted easily under the blade. No! Don't you dare! I wouldn't look around, wouldn't give her a chance to push me away. She was stronger down here, perhaps because it had happened here. Was that possible? I didn't know and didn't care. All I cared about was getting this done. Where the roots were thicker, I hacked through them with the pruning knife. Leave me be! Now I didn't look around, risked one quick glance because of the unnatural crackling sounds which had accompanied her voice, which now seemed to make her voice. The Green Lady was gone. The birch had somehow become Sarah Tidwell. It was Sarah's face growing out of the crisscrossing branches and shining leaves. That rain-slicked face swayed, dissolved, came together, melted away, came together again. For a moment, all the mystery I had sensed down here was revealed. Her damp, shifting eyes were utterly human. They stared at me with hate and supplication. "I ain't done," she cried in a cracked, breaking voice. "He was the worst, don't you understand? He was the worst, and it's his blood in her, and I won't rest until I have it out." There was a gruesome ripping sound. She had inhabited the birch, made it into a physical body of some sort, and intended to tear it free of the earth. She would come and get me with it if she could, kill me with it if she could, strangle me in limber branches, stuff me with leaves until I looked like a Christmas decoration. No matter how much of a monster he was, Kyra had nothing to do with what he did, I said, and you won't have her. Yes, I will, the Green Lady screamed. The ripping, rending sounds were louder now. They were joined by a hissing, shaky crackle. I didn't look around again. I didn't dare look around. I dug faster instead. "Yes, I will have her," she cried, and now the voice was closer. She was coming for me, but I refused to see. When it comes to walking trees and bushes, I'll stick to Macbeth, thanks. "I will have her. He took mine, and I mean to take his." "Go away," a new voice said. The spade loosened in my hands, almost fell. I turned and saw Joe standing below me and to my right. She was looking at Sarah, who had materialized into a lunatic's hallucination, a monstrous greenish-black thing that slipped with every step it tried to walk along the street. She had left the birch behind, yet assumed its vitality somehow, the actual tree huddled behind her, black and shriveled and dead. The creature born of it looked like the bride of Frankenstein as sculpted by Picasso. In it, Sarah's face came and went, came and went. The shape, I thought coldly. It was always real, and if it was always me, it was always her, too. Joe was dressed in the white shirt and blue slacks she'd had on the day she died. I couldn't see the lake through her, as I had been able to see it through DeVore and DeVore's young friends. She had materialized herself completely. I felt a curious draining sensation at the back of my skull, and thought I knew how.
"Get out, bitch!" the Sarah thing snarled.
It raised its arms toward Joe, as it had raised them to me in my worst nightmares.
"Not at all."
Joe's voice remained calm. She turned toward me.
"Hurry, Mike. You have to be quick. It's not really her anymore. She's let one of the outsiders in, and they're very dangerous."
"Joe, I love you."
"I love you, too."
Sarah shrieked, and then began to spin. Leaves and branches blurred together and lost coherence. It was like watching something liquefy in a blender. The entity, which had only looked a little like a woman to begin with, now dropped its masquerade entirely. Something elemental and grotesquely inhuman began to form out of the maelstrom. It leaped at my wife. When it struck her, the color and solidity left Joe as if slapped away by a huge hand. She became a phantom struggling with the thing which raved and shrieked and clawed at her.
"Hurry, Mike!" she screamed. "Hurry!"
I bent to the job. The spade struck something that wasn't dirt, wasn't stone, wasn't wood. I scraped along it, revealing a filthy, mold-crusted swatch of canvas. Now I dug like a madman, wanting to clear as much of the buried object as I could, wanting to fatten my chances of success as much as I could. Behind me, the shape screamed in fury and my wife screamed in pain. Sarah had given up part of her discorporate self in order to gain her revenge, had let in something Joe called an outsider. I had no idea what that might be and never wanted to know. Sarah was its conduit, I knew that much. And if I could take care of her in time... I reached into the dripping hole, slapping wet earth from the ancient canvas. Faint stenciled letters appeared when I did. J.M. McCurdy Sawmill. McCurdy's had burned in the fires of 33, I knew. I'd seen a picture of it in flames somewhere. As I seized the canvas, the tips of my fingers punching through and letting out a fresh billow of green and gassy stench, I could hear grunting. I could hear DeVore. He's lying on top of her and grunting like a pig. Sarah is semi-conscious, muttering unintelligibly through bruised lips which are shiny with blood. DeVore is looking back over his shoulder at Draper Finney and Fred Dean. They have raced after the boy and brought him back, but he won't stop yelling. He's yelling to beat the band, yelling to wake the dead. And if they can hear the Methodists singing How I Love to Tell the Story over here, then they may be able to hear the yowling nigger over there. DeVore says, "Put him in the water. Shut him up." The minute he says it, as though the words are magic words, his cock begins to stiffen.
"What do you mean?" Ben Merrill asks.
"You know goddamn well," Jared says.
He pants the words out, jerking his hips as he speaks. His narrow ass gleams in the afternoon light.
"He's seen us. You want to cut his throat, get his blood all over you? Fine by me. Here, take my knife. Be my guest."
"And no, Jared," Ben cries in horror, actually seeming to cringe at the sight of the knife. He is finally ready. It takes him a little longer, that's all. He ain't a kid like these other ones. But now... Never mind her smart mouth. Never mind her insolent way of laughing. Never mind the whole township. Let them all show up and watch if they like. He slips it to her, what she's wanted all along, what all her kind want. He slips it in and sinks it deep. He continues giving orders even as he rapes her. Up and down his ass goes, tick-tock, just like a cat's tail.
"Somebody take care of him, or do you want to spend 40 years rotting in Shawshank because of a nigger boy's tattle?"
Ben seizes one of Keto Tidwell's arms, Oren Peebles the other. But by the time they have dragged him as far as the embankment, they have lost their heart. Raping an uppity nigger woman with the gall to laugh at Jared when he fell down and split his britches is one thing. Drowning a scared kid like a kitten in a mud puddle, that's another one altogether. They loosen their grips, staring into each other's haunted eyes, and Keto pulls free.
"Run, honey! Sarah cries. Run away and get...
Jared clamps his hands around her throat and begins choking. The boy trips over his own berry bucket and thumps gracelessly to the ground. Harry and Draper recapture him easily.
What you gonna do? Draper asks in a kind of desperate whine, and Harry replies,
what I have to. That's what he replied, and now I was going to do what I had to, in spite of the stench, in spite of Sarah, in spite of my dead wife's shrieks. I hauled the roll of canvas out of the ground. The ropes which had tied it shut at either end held, but the roll itself split down the middle with a hideous burping sound.
Hurry, Joe cried. I can't hold it much longer.
It snarled. It bayed like a dog. There was a loud wooden crunch, like a door being slammed hard enough to splinter, and Joe wailed. I grabbed for the carry bag with slips and greens printed on the front and tore it open as... Harry, the others call him Irish because of his carrot-colored hair, grabs the struggling kid in a clumsy kind of bear hug and jumps into the lake with him. The kid struggles harder than ever. His straw hat comes off and floats on the water.
Get that, Harry pants.
Fred Dean kneels and fishes out the dripping hat. Fred's eyes are dazed. He's got the look of a fighter about one round from hitting the canvas. Behind them, Sarah Tidwell has begun to rattle deep in her chest and throat. Like the sight of the boy's clenching hand, these sounds will haunt Draper Finney until his final dive into Eve's quarry. Jared sinks his fingers deeper, pumping and choking at the same time, the sweat pouring off of him. No amount of washing will take the smell of that sweat out of these clothes, and when he begins to think of it as murder sweat, he burns the clothes to get shed of it. Harry Oster wants to be shed of it all, to be shed of it and never see these men again, most of all Jared DeVore, who he now thinks must be Lord Satan himself. Harry cannot go home and face his father unless this nightmare is over, buried. And his mother? How can he ever face his beloved mother, Bridget Oster, with her round, sweet Irish face and graying hair and comforting shelf of bosom? Bridget, who has always had a kind word or a soothing hand for him. Bridget Oster, who has been saved, washed in the blood of the Lamb. Bridget Oster, who is even now serving pies at the picnic they're having at the new church. Bridget Oster, who is Mama. How can he ever look at her again, or she him, if he has to stand in court on a charge of raping and beating a woman, even a black woman? So he yanks the clinging boy away. Keto scratches him once, just a nick on the side of the neck, and that night Harry will tell his Mama it was a brush pricker that caught him unaware, and he will let her put a kiss on it. And then he plunges the child into the lake. Keto looks up at him, his face shimmering, and Harry sees a little fish flick by. A perch, he thinks. For an instant, he wonders what the boy must see, looking up through the silver shield of the surface at the face of the fellow who's holding him down, the fellow who's drowning him, and then Harry pushes that away. Just a nigger, he reminds himself desperately. That's all he is, just a nigger, no kin of yours. Keto's arm comes out of the water, his dripping, dark brown arm. Harry pulls back, not wanting to be clawed, but the hand doesn't reach for him, only sticks straight up. The fingers curl into a fist, open, curl into a fist, open, curl into a fist. The boy's thrashing begins to ease, the kicking feet begin to slow down. The eyes, looking up into Harry's eyes, are taking on a curiously dreamy look. And still that brown arm sticks straight up. Still the hand opens and closes, opens and closes. Draper Finney stands on the shore crying, sure that now someone will come along. Now someone will see the terrible thing they have done. The terrible thing they are, in fact, still doing. Be sure your sin will find you out, it says in the good book. Be sure. He opens his mouth to tell Harry to quit. Maybe it's still not too late to take it back. Let him up. Let him live. But no sound comes out. Behind him, Sarah is choking her last. In front of him, her drowning son's hand opens and closes. Opens and closes.
the reflection of it shimmering on the water, and Draper thinks, won't it stop? Won't it ever stop doing that? And as if it was a prayer that something is now answering, the boy's locked elbow begins to bend, and his arm begins to sag. The fingers begin to close again into a fist and then stop. For a moment the hand wavers, and then... I slam the heel of my hand into the center of my forehead to clear these phantoms away. Behind me there was a frenzied snap and crackle of wet bushes as Joe and whatever she was holding back continued to struggle. I put my hands inside the split in the canvas like a doctor spreading a wound. I yanked. There was a low ripping sound as the roll tore the rest of the way up and down. Inside was what remained of them. Two yellowed skulls, forehead to forehead, as if in intimate conversation, a woman's faded red leather belt, a molder of clothes, and a heap of bones. Two rib cages, one large and one small. Two sets of legs, one long and one short. The early remains of Sarah and Keto Tidwell, buried here by the lake for almost 100 years. The larger of the two skulls turned. It glared at me with its empty eye sockets. Its teeth chattered as if it would bite me, and the bones below it began a tenebrous, jittery stirring. Some broke apart immediately. All were soft and pitted. The red belt stirred restlessly, and the rusty buckle rose like the head of a snake. "Mike!" Joe screamed. "Quick! Quick!" I pulled the sack out of the carry bag and grabbed the plastic bottle which had been inside. "Lie still," the Magnabet letters had said. Another little word trick. Another message passed behind the unsuspecting guard's back. Sarah Tidwell was a fearsome creature, but she had underestimated Joe, and she had underestimated the telepathy of long association as well. I had gone to Slips and Greens. I had bought a bottle of lye, and now I opened it and poured it, smoking, over the bones of Sarah and her son. There was a hissing sound like the one you hear when you open a beer or a bottled soft drink. The belt buckle melted. The bones turned white and crumpled like things made out of sugar. I had a nightmare image of Mexican children eating candy corpses off long sticks on the Day of the Dead. The eye sockets of Sarah's skull widened as the lie filled the dark hollow where her mind, her prodigious talent, and her laughing soul had once resided. It was an expression that looked at first like surprise and then like sorrow. The jaw fell off. The nubs of the teeth sizzled away. The top of the skull caved in. Spread finger bones jittered, then melted. "Oh." It whispered through the soaking trees like a rising wind, only the wind had died as the wet air caught its breath before the next onslaught. It was a sound of unspeakable grief and longing and surrender. I sensed no hate in it. Her hate was gone, burned away in the corrosive I had bought in Helen Oster's shop. The sound of Sarah's going was replaced by the plaintive, almost human cry of a bird, and it awakened me from the place where I had been, brought me finally and completely out of the zone. I got shakily to my feet, turned around, and looked at the street. Joe was still there, a dim form through which I could now see the lake and the dark clouds of the next thunder squall coming over the mountains. Something flickered beyond her, that bird venturing out of its safe cove for a peek at the rearranged environment, perhaps. But I barely registered that. It was Joe I wanted to see. Joe who had come God knew how far and suffered God knew how much to help me. She looked exhausted, hurt, in some fundamental way diminished. But the other thing, the outsider, was gone. Joe, standing in a ring of birch leaves so dead they looked charred, turned to me and smiled. "Joe, we did it." Her mouth moved. I heard the words, but they were too distant to make out. She was standing right there, but she might have been calling across a wide canyon. Still, I understood her. I read the words off her lips, if you prefer the rational, right out of her mind, if you prefer the romantical. I prefer the latter. Marriage is a zone, too, you know. Marriage is a zone. So, that's all right, isn't it?